Welcome to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. 40 years ago this week, the Supreme Court issued the Roe v. Wade decision, which legalized abortion in the United States. That created an enormous change for women seeking abortion and for healthcare professionals who provide those services. One of today's guests, Carol Joffe, writes about one abortion provider's response to the news that day back on January 22, 1973. He said, "The news came over the radio. It was just an overwhelming feeling. I got tears in my eyes. At last, it was all over. Finally, never again the fear, the threat of going to prison, the fear of the woman not being able to get service. It was a new day." Those were the words of an anonymous abortion doctor back in 1973. Many of us today can't remember a time before the reality of the Roe v. Wade decision. But in the 40 years since that decision, women's reproductive rights have been severely restricted state by state. 135 abortion controls were created in the last 2 years alone, such as requiring mandatory ultrasounds, limiting insurance coverage, mandating parental involvement, banning late-term abortion, requiring mandatory counseling, and increasing clinic regulations. So even though abortions are fundamentally legal in the United States, they're becoming less and less accessible, especially for women who don't have money. Four states have only one abortion clinic now, and those places are under constant threat. So where are we now, 40 years after the Roe decision? Another one of our guests, Reverend Darcy Baxter with the Unitarian Universalist Church, says, "I cannot really imagine what it was like before Roe. This is the gift that those who came before have bestowed upon us. In our strides toward freedom, Roe v. Wade is a huge landmark." So today we're going to talk about the legacy of Roe v. Wade. How has it changed your life? Are you following the fight to restrict access to abortion around the country? And what needs to happen now to give women control over their reproductive choices and health? Well, to sort out a lot of these issues, joining us today, we've got Carol Joffe, who's a professor at the Bixby Center for Global Reproductive Health at UCSF, and she's a professor emerita at UC Davis. Dr. Joffe has specialized in the study of abortion provision and providers. And her most recent book is Dispatches from the Abortion Wars, The Costs of Fanaticism to Doctors, Patients, and the Rest of Us. Hi.
Hi. Happy to be here.
Thank you for being with us. We're also joined in studio by Darcy Baxter, who is a Unitarian Universalist minister who's currently serving the Star King Unitarian Church in Hayward as their Director of Family Ministry. And she's counseled hundreds of women about abortion working at the National Abortion Federation. Hi, Darcy.
Hi.
Thank you for joining us. We also have on the phone from New York, Jasmine Burnett is a writer, consultant, and reproductive justice activist who works on policy and advocacy issues that impact Black women and girls. She's a founding member of Trust Black Women Partnership, which is a national network of Black women leaders and organizations that mobilized against the 2010-2011 anti-abortion billboard campaign. Hi, Jasmine.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm delighted to be with all of you and to learn more about this issue, the past and the future. So speaking of the past, let's take a minute to go back over some of the details of the case, Roe v. Wade, and its significance. We know that it was the Supreme Court case that legalized abortion, but I don't know what led up to that. I mean, like I said, I can't remember a time before Roe. So I'm wondering, Carol, if you can talk to us about the fight that led up to Roe and how historic that decision really was.
Well, I do remember the time before Roe. It was a very, very difficult time for women facing unwanted pregnancies. The first generation of reliable oral contraception didn't really happen till the 60s. And was not widely available. So for women facing unwanted pregnancies, a very difficult time. The coat hanger is not just a cliche. Many, many women tried to self-abort. Many women went to the notorious, quote, back alley butchers. Many women died. We don't know how many, but estimates, some reliable public health researchers put it around 5,000 a year in the years leading up to Roe dying. Many more women injured, lost a reproductive capacity. But I also want to say it was a very, very difficult time for doctors as well. When abortion became criminalized by the end of the 19th century, and before then it was neither legal or illegal, it just was, It didn't ban all abortions. It said the only abortions that can take place are those that doctors approve of. But many doctors operated in the gray area. They didn't know what actually constituted a legitimate exception. So it was very, very difficult. And in the years leading up to Roe, it just became more and more untenable. There was a very famous case that galvanized American public opinion. Sherry Chasen Finkbein was a TV host in Phoenix, Arizona, mother of five children, pregnant with her sixth. Her husband came back from Europe with what he thought was a safe sleeping pill, thalidomide, which many of your listeners will know was very shortly thereafter shown to cause horrific fetal anomalies. Children, if they were born alive, born without limbs. Her doctor arranged an abortion, but then in an extraordinary act of decency, she went public with it. She wanted other women who had taken this pill to know. The hospital freaked out, was afraid of the publicity. Long story short, she had to go to Sweden to have her abortion. Her fetus actually was stillborn with missing limbs. Life magazine did a cover story on her. This really swayed public opinion. Meanwhile, the AMA had reversed its 100-year-old opposition to abortion and said the situation we have now is untenable. We must have legal abortion.
So that's what led us to the Roe decision. Let's talk a little bit about what's happened since then. Really, it galvanized the anti-abortion activists to really mobilize around this. And at the time of Ronald Reagan's presidency in 1980, that seems to be when the tide started turning. And after the 2010 elections, that's when we've seen the most restrictions ever happening. And anti-abortion activists are actually using Roe, the decision in Roe, to argue for women's health changes to restrict access to abortion.
That is correct. You are absolutely right. The campaign, Ronald Reagan's electoral campaign in 1980, really brought this newly formed, or rather recently formed, anti-abortion movement into the political process. Once Reagan got elected, with incredible help, hard work from the anti-abortion movement, this began what we now know of as the litmus test. Republican presidents would only appoint people to high office, such as the Supreme Court, such as the Surgeon General, such as the bureaucratic official in charge of family planning program, if they were against abortion. This reached ludicrous heights during the presidency of George W. Bush, when people who were appointed to positions having nothing to do with abortion, for example, positions in the Green Zone in Iraq and the Coalition Provisional Authority, people were asked, what is your position on Roe v. Wade? So, yes, abortion has become the defining issue of the contemporary Republican Party.
Which is really interesting, and I'd like to hear from all of you, and I'll invite our callers in just a moment. Why do you think it is that 40 years after Roe, in the 21st century, when women have unprecedented access to college and to higher education and to positions of power and leadership, why are we still debating a woman's right to make choices about her own health and her reproductive health? Carol, you wrote, you think that the changing relationship between genders, the place of women in the public sphere, and the legitimacy of sexual activity separated from procreation is a larger frame behind some of these debates over, you know, whether a clinic should have walls that are 5 feet wider.
Well, yes. I mean, the gender revolution that started more or less around the same time as the Roe decision. In fact, feminist health activists from that quote second wave feminist movement were very central, along with the medical community, in pushing for legalization. But the issues brought forward that sex is really okay apart from procreation, apart from marriage. These were and still remain very difficult issues.
And what's nice is we have an intergenerational panel here. So I'd like to pull Darcy and Jasmine in. because I want to ask you that same question. Why is it that right now, at this particular historical period, we're debating this more than we have probably since Roe or the years immediately leading up to it? What's happened? Is it because this next wave of women didn't follow this issue? What do you think is happening? Let me start with you, Darcy, and then I'll pull you in, Jasmine.
Yeah. As Carol said, I think there's ways that Roe v. Wade there was a huge historical significance. And I think about Professor Beverly Harrison, a feminist theologian who was at Union. She talked about how legal abortion for the first time would give women absolute control about when they had children. And, you know, I think about how some of us talk about abortion as just the tip of an iceberg for a whole worldview and a set of values. And there's ways I think that liberals and the left didn't appreciate the seismic change that Roe signaled. I think there's this image I've seen of a woman, and I read her she was about her 60s, and she's carrying a sign that says, I thought we settled this in the 70s. And I look at that, and part of me feels very sad or thinking about how she must feel. But there's also, wow, to some extent, there was an amount of hubris. You thought this, that the issues regarding women and reproduction, misogyny, all of this stuff, that could have been settled in the 70s. Roe was a seismic shift, and I don't think liberals at the time appreciated it.
Yeah, but I'm wondering, did our generation drop the ball on this?
Which generation?
The generation sort of that was born when Roe passed.
This, and Jasmine, I would love to hear.
Yeah, I want to hear from Jasmine.
Yeah, that there's, there was.
Here, Darcy, think about that. Let's pull Jasmine in. Go ahead. Jasmine, what do you think about this question of why are we talking about this on these terms 40 years after Roe?
I think we're still talking about it 40 years after Roe because patriarchy still guides how our society views the female body and our decisions and our choices. And when you look at sexual violence, be that psychological or physical or political violence that are committed against women and our decision-making ability to make decisions about our reproductive lives and health, you find that patriarchy fits squarely in terms of the barriers to that. And I think that in reference to your question about activists dropping the ball, I think that we didn't drop the ball. We essentially are carrying the baton.
So think of this as a relay race as opposed to a
This is a
sprint.
Relay race. This is a marathon. I mean, these issues, and they actually come back. You find that you run into some of the same runners who were leading the fight, you know, to protect, to implement, you know, Roe v. Wade. But I want to say that also when I think about Roe v. Wade and, you know, its importance 40 years from now, I also think about the Hyde Amendment. Mm-hmm. You talk about women having access to abortion care and abortion services and it being something that is our right, it's our reproductive right, but not every woman has full access. In fact, many women are denied abortion services under the Hyde Amendment.
Can you remind all of us what the Hyde Amendment is, Jasmine?
Yes, absolutely. The Hyde Amendment, the federal government essentially denies poor women, women of color, women in the military, and immigrants the ability to make their own decisions about their pregnancy and childbearing. And this is because Medicaid, which is a federal and state government program that entitles beneficiaries the right to health care, falls under the category of all of the women that I listed before in terms of their health care coverage. So, and then when we talk about the global impact of, you know, access to abortion care, you know, and the impact of U.S. policies on that, then we have to look at the Helms Amendment, which was actually passed in 1973, the same year that Roe was passed, and then, of course, the Hyde Amendment in 1976. So it is my hope that this kind of focus on Roe v. Wade and the 40th anniversary and celebrating access to choice really extends and builds momentum for the 40th anniversary of the Hyde Amendment and dismantling that as a barrier for women who, poor women who don't have access to abortion care.
Well, and that's the tragic irony about the 40th anniversary of Roe is that there's less access in some ways now than there was in 1973. Darcy, you wanted to weigh in.
Yeah, I'm thinking about on Sunday we held a public service and Vanessa Daniel from the Groundswell Fund, she offered this really poignant image about, she talked about her mother who was a white second wave feminist, what it Roe represented for her is that there was so much pressure on white women to have children. But for many women of color, the pressure was not to have children. And you talked about a generation of activists. Have we dropped the ball? And I think what we've been wrestling with, that Roe was so significant and it did not speak to everybody's life experience regarding pregnancy. Yes, you should, you know, it's about the right not to have children, but it's the right to have children and raise them in dignity. Mm-hmm. And Vanessa, as she was speaking, talked about you need to understand gender justice and racial justice as the right foot and the left foot. And there's been some real tension, I think, within the movement about what it means not just to prioritize one story or one type of life experience regarding pregnancy and being a parent.
And Jasmine, do you want to talk about that? Have there been strides within the women's movement to bridge some of these class and race divides?
I would say in the reproductive justice movement, there absolutely has been a lot of bridge building. And I will say that was in terms of how the framework operates, you know, it's intersectionality. We don't prioritize one intersecting oppression, be it sexuality, immigration status, class, race, gender. We don't prioritize that over the other because when we walk into a room and when we experience life, we experience oppression at all of those intersections. And I believe that that is something, and then that is a human rights framework that we can all connect with because somehow, you know, our oppressions really touch each other. So I feel that in being able to have conversations about reproductive justice and really using that framework to help guide our work, I believe that we really are chipping away at those barriers. And I think that, you know, people are understanding that the women who are the subjects of direct racially motivated, gender, sexual motivated oppression, they need to be the spokespersons for themselves. And I think that that's where the respect factor comes in with the quality and allyship
and that's
that I see through reproductive justice.
Jasmine Burnett is a writer, consultant, and reproductive justice activist who is a founding member of the Trust Black Women Partnership. We're also speaking with Darcy Baxter, who's a Unitarian Universalist minister, currently serving the Star King Church in Hayward as the Director of Family Ministry. And we're also joined by Carol Jaffe, who's a professor at the Bixby Center for Global Reproductive Health at UCSF. And her most recent book is Dispatches from the Abortion Wars, The Costs of Fanaticism to Doctors, Patients, and the Rest of Us. We're talking about the historic Roe v. Wade decision and what it's meant for women's reproductive health in the last 40 years and where we're at right now with regards to women's rights with regard to reproductive health. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. We have a lot of callers already on the line, so I'm going to ask you just to be patient with us. We're going to get to you very, very soon. But I wanted to, you mentioned, Jasmine, having a human rights framework for this debate, and I wanted to ask all of you, what do you consider the reasonable arguments by those who oppose abortion because they believe that that is taking a life? What do you think is reasonable about that perspective? Darcy, you want to start?
It's, you know, I have sympathy for when if you consider it a human life, a pregnancy, a human life, what does it mean to end it? And I think about, I gave a talk and an abortion provider afterwards came up to me and talked about Catholic ethics professor he had who said, life most certainly has individuals, but whether individuals have life is a whole nother matter. And I talked about earlier kind of abortion as a whole nother, as is a tip of an iceberg for a whole worldview. And I think I would say that those on the left really appreciate an ecological, interdependent web of life model of understanding how we live and how we make decisions, and that it's very normal within life. Things end all the time. We die. It's a normal part of being alive. And I think there's some deep anxieties about death, about life, that for the other side really fuel, you know, what does it mean to take a life? And I can appreciate that. I also think, though, it can be extraordinarily narrow, and there's a failure to see the profound suffering and messiness of our living. So, yeah.
Let me put that same question to you, Jasmine. We just have a minute before we go to the break, but what do you think is a reasonable argument by those who are opposed to abortion?
Well, I'll speak to my experiences working with in the Black community, and I would say that those who in the Black community who are opposed to abortion and those of us who are on the pro-choice side, I believe that we both have a deep concern for the Black community and the impact of medical oppressive, reproductive oppressions that have been tested on the Black community that affects our trust of the medical establishment in general. But as far as it impacting their decision on, you know, the fetus, the importance of the mother and the fetus, I believe that it is the mother's choice based on her ethical value system, her community, her family, and her own decision. And I believe that that is where we have to lead when we talk about where we connect and where we disconnect.
And Jasmine, let me throw the question also to Carol just before we go to a break. You've got about 2 minutes, Carol.
Thank you. Well, I think the question you raised, Holly, really goes to the heart of the of what kind of democracy we want. I mean, some people genuinely believe abortion is taking a human life and therefore should not occur. I believe we should respect those beliefs. No one is forced against her will to have an abortion. Abortion clinics for years have tried to screen out coercion. But some people do not believe an abortion is taking a human life equivalent to that of the human. And I just want to quote my friend and colleague, the late Dr. George Tiller, who was very tragically assassinated several years ago as he stood in church in Kansas. And what he said to me when I first interviewed him, now many years ago, he said, "I've never heard a fetus talk to me. I've heard thousands of women talk to me about their pain, their desperation, their panic." And I think when we actually look at the circumstances of real women in the real world, you know, these abstract arguments only go so far.
And that's Carol Jaffe. She's the author of The Dispatches from the Abortion Wars, The Costs of Fanaticism to Doctors, Patients, and the Rest of Us. We're also joined by Darcy Baxter, who's a Unitarian Universalist minister, currently serving the Star King Unitarian Church in Hayward as the Director of Family Ministry. She's counseled hundreds of women about abortion, having worked at the National Abortion Federation. We're also joined by phone from New York by Jasmine Burnett, who's a writer, consultant, and reproductive justice activist. And she is a founding member of the Trust Black Women Partnership, which is a national network of black women leaders and organizations that mobilized against the anti-abortion billboard campaign in New York City. We'll hopefully we'll get a chance to talk to you about that after the break, and we'll also get to your calls. I want to let people know that Rose Aguilar this Saturday will be moderating a Roe v. Wade celebration that starts at 10 a.m. at Justin Herman Plaza in San Francisco, downtown San Francisco. All of that information is at yourcallradio.org. Sandra Fluke will also be there. That's this Saturday at 10 a.m. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after a short break.
Call on KALW to take part in today's conversation. You can call 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We'd love to hear new voices. And if you prefer to write rather than call, you can send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. You can also post comments there and continue the discussions that you hear on Your Call. Tomorrow, we're going to get responses to Jerry Brown's State of the State address. How do we recover from the deep cuts to social services that have been made over the last couple of years? Friday, of course, is our weekly media roundtable where we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And today we're talking about the status of reproductive rights and how it's changed over the past four decades. This week marks the 40th anniversary of the historic Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion in the U.S. Even though an overwhelming majority of people support abortion, state laws restricting abortion are on the rise. So what are the realities for women seeking abortions 40 years after Roe v. Wade? And I want to remind everybody that this Saturday, Rose Aguilar will be moderating a Roe v. Wade celebration, which starts at 10 a.m. at Justin Herman Plaza in San Francisco. That is this Saturday in downtown San Francisco. Sandra Fluke will also be there. You can go to yourcallradio.org for more information. We have full calls, and I want to get to some of those calls and emails. The number to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. Here's, ready, one more time, 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can put comments at yourcallradio.org. And let me go now. First, let me give you a little bit of statistical information. A new Wall Street Journal NBC News poll found that 7 in 10 Americans believe Roe v. Wade should remain law. That's the highest level of support for reproductive justice since polls began tracking the public's views on abortion in 1989. And last August, Republicans for Choice released a poll showing that 71% of Republicans believe women should make their own reproductive choices, not the government. So those are just some interesting statistics, and we'll talk about how public policy is informing public debate and how public debate is informing public policy. But let's go first to KDF in Oakland. Hi, KDF. Thank you for being so patient.
Oh, no problem. I have a quick aside before my story, and that is, to me, the abortion fight at its core is the fear of female sovereignty. That is, men who lack confidence are desperate about controlling women since they don't have control over their own insecurities. But anyway, my story is that while I was at San Francisco State, before Roe was the law of the land, there was a woman who didn't return to school one autumn since she bled to death on a table in Tijuana. And then fast forward a number of years, when I was working at the Bay Area women's newspaper Plexus, there was a woman named Toni Delacorte who started Media Alliance, and I was always on her side, in every debate, because she looked exactly like the woman who had died during that abortion.
Wow. Well, thank you for that, KDF. Do you want to respond to her? Yeah.
I think about the question you asked earlier about in these past 40 years and younger generations, whether we've dropped the ball. And I think that pre-Roe v. Wade, the tragedy was so present in so many of our lives. Women were bleeding out in hospitals. And so it was so easy to connect on a visceral level. And in the past 40 years, you know, myself, I have been blessed to hear so many women's stories, but that kind of intimate encounter with women bleeding out in hospitals, that hasn't been there for me. And so I think the level of, how do you connect to an issue when you don't necessarily have that kind of tragedy right in your face?
Well, and that was one thing that I was reading about, a lot of these limitations on abortion, that they're very hard to campaign against. How do you campaign against a law that just makes the hallway have to be 5 feet long, wider? Maybe it seems very reasonable, but also how do you mount a campaign against that sort of legislation, or the legislation, I believe, that says that abortion providers have to have admitting permission for local hospitals, and local hospitals won't allow that. And abortion providers are coming from out of state into places like North Dakota, et cetera. That's a real issue here in terms of framing this debate and in terms of getting mobilizing people.
No, that's absolutely correct. For a long time, people thought the violence against abortion providers was something that would keep abortion provision down, that people wouldn't want to go in this field. You know, but to a remarkable extent, we have a new generation of younger doctors, mainly women, who are willing to do this. The violence is still an issue.
It's a big issue.
It's a big issue, but it's not, it's a very serious issue, but it's not the primary one. Just to go back to the thing you mentioned, Holly, restrictions that say the hallway should be 5 feet wider. I mean, you can't get a million people to march in Washington, protesting a hallway.
Make it 4 feet.
Yes.
On the other hand, that's what will put clinics out of business.
Right. But that's what's been very, very wise, strategy-wise.
It's been a brilliant strategy to conform to these so-called ambulatory surgery center requirements.
Which are justified by saying this is about women's reproductive
health.
But
it's not about women's safety. I mean, and in other words, the overwhelming consensus is that it has everything to do with shutting down the clinics. And the governor of Mississippi, to his great credit, whether he meant to or not, was unusually candid about it. He said, we will put in various restrictions. For example, that providers have to have local admitting privileges, because that's what will shut down the one remaining clinic in Mississippi.
Well, one of the things that you wrote about in your article in Dissent recently was that one of the requirements is saying that providers have to give misinformation to patients. Can you explain what specifically you're talking about?
Happening? This is really. Off the charts, unreasonable. Doctors take an oath when they become doctors, to do no harm, to say no untruths. In a number of states, doctors really have to give patients scripts of information that's not true.
Like what?
That abortion causes breast cancer, that abortion causes suicide, that abortion causes this unknown mental illness called post-abortion syndrome, that if you have an abortion, you will become infertile.
You say that this is elevating junk science.
This is elevating junk science. A number 20, according to the Guttmacher Institute, that's the leading research organization that tracks abortion restrictions, 20 states have these scripts that doctors must tell patients that are simply untrue.
And so how, if they're really untrue, what's the science behind them? How is this justified? How does it pass a legislature?
It's not justified.
Everybody's throwing up their hands right now going, no, it's not.
There's no science.
In this past election, even though Obama won, even though it was very clear that abortion and contraception were major issues, nonetheless, we have 30 states with Republican governors. Many of these states have all Republican assemblies and senates. So basically anything can pass. They don't need, quote, justification. They point to, quote, junk science studies that say abortion causes breast cancer, even though again and again it's been shown by reliable researchers that it does not.
So let me read a couple of emails and then go to another caller. Susie says, I heard you. Uh-oh, my screen just moved. Susie says, I heard you talking about Roe v. Wade this morning, and I wanted to let you know about a powerful film at Sundance right now called After Tiller.
Yeah.
It's a moving and intimate film about the four doctors in the U.S. who still do third trimester abortions and the patients that they serve. Brings missing voices to the abortion discussion and answers many questions. So that movie is called After Tiller. You sound like you're familiar.
I've seen it. I've reviewed it for Ms. Magazine, and it's an incredibly powerful film. And I look forward to it coming to the Bay Area soon.
And another listener emails, great discussion. While it's true that the great majority of Americans agree that abortion should remain legal, I believe the majority of both women and men do not support completely unrestricted access to abortion, including probably late-term abortion. I've often wondered if advances in medicine over the last 40 years, especially in the ability of doctors to save the lives of increasingly premature infants, as well as more readily available and more advanced ultrasounds, has affected many people's feelings about abortion. What does your panel think? Darcy and then Carol and then Jasmine. Yeah.
Again, the advances in technology have definitely been capitalized by those who oppose access to abortion. And one of the difficulties as in the pro-choice movement is for a long time there was kind of a stance that, it was just a clump of cells. And because I've had, been blessed to talk with so many women, it's messy and complicated, and there's various levels of attachment. You know, some women feel that it's absolutely their a baby, and yet they still need to make the decision to terminate, and other women don't. And there are just so many differing experiences. It's not conducive to kind of one, you know, one easy soundbite. Women's lives, our family lives, are messy and complicated.
Yeah, just to give some context to the caller's point, excuse me, only 1.5% of abortions take place after 20 weeks. And I think one of the most brilliant campaigns of the anti-abortion movement was to convince people, making up a term, quote, partial birth abortion, which exists nowhere in medical literature. I mean, they basically convinced people that half of all abortions take place at, you know, 2 weeks before, you know, the baby would be born. So just to put in context, this is rarely done. Only a few states allow procedures after 24 weeks under very strict circumstances. In fact, the movie that you mentioned, Holly.
After Tiller,
profiles some of the doctors who do these. But one other point that the caller made, which I think is a very astute one, there's no question that the rise of ultrasound, which was not prevalent in 73, when Roe happened. I mean, there's no question that the rise of ultrasonography has really changed the debate.
It has really changed the way that we look at a fetus.
That's right.
Right? Yes. And how we perceive this third trimester of life or fetal. Yeah, go ahead.
You can go to many academic medical centers and their neonatal intensive care units, and you have premature 24 weekers.
I know some people who were born very premature, you know, 6 to 8 weeks before.
You know, and I had a moment. I served as a chaplain on a neonatal intensive care unit, and after spending time doing abortion counseling, and it was one of those moments where I realized, as I said, I use this term messy and complicated, that, you know, I could look at a 24 weeker, and yet because I had talked to so many women, that's life. There are some women at 24 weeks where their life circumstances dictate that, and then another woman needs to have their 24 weeker in the NICU.
And let's go to Kevin in San Francisco. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to your call. Thanks for waiting.
Hey, good morning. It seems to me that for those opposed to abortion, they should be advocating for contraception, dissemination, and free and available ways for women to prevent pregnancy. But they're not doing that. What we're seeing 40 years later is a very organized opposition on a RICO level, where they're conspiring to abrogate women's rights guaranteed by the Supreme Court. This is the law of the land. So when places are, as the doctor mentioned, legislating width of hallways, etc., I would love to hear from a legal scholar about this, because more as much as a medical right, this is a women's legal right, and to try to abrogate women's right to abortion is a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. This is going after a gender, and even using some neutral statute like the width of a hallway, as the Supreme Court decided more than 100 years ago in a Chinese laundry case, if a law set on, sorry to get a little esoteric.
What case are you referring to, Kevin, just out of curiosity?
This is the Yik Wo case, where basically an ordinance was created ostensibly to advocate for fire safety, and went after wooden buildings in San Francisco. And what the Supreme Court found was that the law, while sounding neutral on its face, was applied in a discriminatory fashion only against Chinese-owned laundries, which mostly were built in wooden buildings. So similarly, a law about the width of hallways is applied against abortion clinics, therefore in a discriminatory fashion, and it doesn't matter if it's neutral on its face. It violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. This is big stuff.
So you're saying that this could be a constitutional issue as opposed to a states' rights issue?
Yes, and what what the right wing is doing is sort of they have their blueprints for going state to state and undercutting the delivery of abortion services in all sorts of these little backbiting ways that really keep abortion clinics closed or prevent them from opening, basically make it very difficult for them to make services available.
Okay, so let me get a response, Kevin. Yeah, go ahead, Darcy, you were saying, and then I'd like to hear from Jasmine on this issue as well.
I was actually just going to say, I think one of the strengths of the pro-choice movement has been its focus on legalities. It's also been our weakness. It takes more than legal access. And, you know, the reproductive justice movement and framework, and I'd love to hear about Jasmine talk about this, is about addressing not just legalities, but access to all to dignity and what it takes to live dignified lives.
Right. So you've got on the books Roe, which grants legal access, but the access on a practical level is being restricted, particularly to low-income women. Jasmine, did you want to weigh in on that? And the question that Kevin brought up about, you know, is this a constitutional issue?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, I think that when you look at clinics like the one that's in Mississippi that is now under the threat of being closed, which I'm sure as a part of the four clinics that you were referring to, I believe that...
Yeah,
you know,
Arkansas, North Dakota, Mississippi, and South Dakota.
Right. And so when you, again, I think we keep talking about, you know, the right to access and how all of these laws kind of chip away at the right, but it's the right, and I keep going back to the denial. I mean, I think we talk about Roe v. Wade as if all women have access to abortion care when, in fact, poor women have limited access to abortion care. So I think that when we're fighting and when we talk about looking at frameworks in an intersectional way, we have to take both into account. So I think it's unconstitutional that women don't have access to the resources due to government health care to get abortion services. And I also think that it's unconstitutional that women's rights are being chipped away at the state level by these backhanded policies that are being introduced that are horrible.
That's Jasmine Burnett. She is a founding member of Trust Black Women Partnership. You talked, Jasmine, about reframing this debate, and I wanted to ask you, Darcy, about an aspect of that. One of the things you're fighting against is the perception that all faith communities are against abortion, and I think a lot of us do have that perception that this is very much a religious battle, and you're saying, no, that's not. And in fact, reproductive justice is going to be the first national social justice priority for the Unitarian Church?
Yes, for the next 4 years, Unitarian Universalist congregations will be focusing on reproductive justice as a study and action issue. And I counsel for Faith Aloud's hotline and women. And there was a woman, young woman who called, had an abortion scheduled for the next day. And she's like, oh, I'm talking to a minister? I thought all religion was against it.
Mm.
And there's a history that's been erased. Leading up to Roe, there was something called the Clergy Consultation Service, where many Protestant and Jewish clergy created a network that referred women to safe abortion providers. And in fact, Roe v. Wade itself, the first Unitarian Church in Dallas, the women's group there provided essential support to Sarah Weddington to take the Roe case. She was a little hesitant and nervous because mm-hmm. it was so controversial. So faith communities have been essential in this fight. And I think similarly, once Roe was passed, a lot of liberal faith communities stopped focusing on it. And also those issues of life, a family, it's messy and complicated, and so there's a hesitancy to step into the fray.
And to talk about this in a more holistic way.
Right.
And when I think the caller mentioned contraception and access to that as being a really big part of this discussion.
Yes.
Let me read from another email from Amy. She says, great show, great questions. We know the anti-choice movement has used a very successful strategy to limit access to abortion. Are we going to just throw up our hands expands, what strategies do you think we should pursue to expand it again? So I'm going to ask that in just a moment, but we have another guest on the line. Julia Redeker Flynn is a youth activist network manager for Advocates for Youth. So Julia, tell us a little bit about what you do, and we can get to Amy's question about what are we going to do about all of these restrictions being placed on women. Hi, Julia. Welcome to your call.
So that's a perfect tee up for what I was thinking about talking about, which is that, what can we do? We've seen these sort of attacks in a bunch of states, and it's been extremely frustrating. You know, as a relatively young person, I, as well as sort of seeing what's going on in Mississippi and all of the states and seeing these laws enacted that will have real harmful consequences, specifically on low-income women, women of color, and young women. In the past couple of months and over the past couple of years, Advocates has been working on developing a campaign. It's called the 1 in 3 campaign, and it's looking to start a new conversation about abortion, which is telling our stories on our own terms. And I heard reflected earlier in the call that one of the things that continues to ground our work in this movement is the honor of talking to women about their actual real lived experiences and understanding that life is messy and complex, and that sort of propels our continuous engagement in this work. And I think, you know, a lot of younger women haven't necessarily heard the pre-Roe stories, but also are experiencing barriers currently in the States and are facing a lot of those similar situations. And so what we've done with this campaign is really focused on people and people's stories with abortion and starting the conversation from that perspective. And we're going around to college campuses and working with young people in that way to talk about abortion from a very personal perspective as a motivating tool to look at some of these other larger consequences and what are the real implications of our lives.
And Julia, thank you so much for joining us. Why don't you stay on the line? We're running out of time here, but I want to get all of you to weigh in on this vision for the future. What do we do about this? And one of our callers that we're not going to have time to get to, Carr in San Diego, asks, is there any kind of coalition building between pro-life and pro-choice groups? So maybe you can address that as you think about this question. Where do we go now? Jasmine, I'm going to start with you.
Well, I think that we continue to build the leadership of the women who have these lived experiences with needing reproductive health services, including abortion care. I think that there may be some level of symmetry between the pro-choice and the pro-life movement in terms of making sure that comprehensive sex education, contraception, and family planning are a part of comprehensive sex education in schools and community education. That's where we can agree.
And is there pushback against that, contraception education in schools? Darcy, you're shaking your head here. Why don't I pull you in?
Absolutely. I think one of the deep frustrations in the movement against abortion, and they've been very good at using a language about caring for women, and yet for those of us who advocate for comprehensive sexuality education, advocating for universal health care, advocating for child care, for supporting our families, many of these groups who use this great language of caring for women, they are not interested in fighting those fights, and which signaled to many of us they have a fundamental different worldview and they are entitled to it, but they believe something very different.
And Carol, I'm going to give you the last word on this. You've got about 2 minutes. Where do we go now? What should we do?
What should we do? I think we should keep doing what we've been doing, but even more so. I mean, the abortion rights movement will always be multi-pronged. I agree with what Darcy said earlier. It shouldn't just be about legal issues, but it absolutely has to include that. I mean, the pro-choice lawyers have worked tirelessly. We would be way worse off without them. We also have to go back or continue with old-fashioned organizing. Mm-hmm. In Michigan, in Virginia, thousands of women and men showed up at the state capitals and didn't get all they wanted, but really forced a certain amount of retreat from anti-abortion forces. And let me just quickly say something, Holly, about I think what one of the callers wrote in. you know, is there any coalitions between pro-choice and pro-life? And the answer is it's been very difficult. I mean, occasionally something happens, but the logical things you think that these two groups would agree on.
Like taking care of children.
You would think that adoption would be a no-brainer. You would think that better birth access to birth control would be a no-brainer. I mean, both sides claim that they believe in that. But the problem is that these issues on the right have become so politicized. So adoption, oh, gay people can adopt? Oh, yep. You mean single people can adopt? No, we can't be part of that coalition. And as we saw in this last coalition, in this last election, the attacks on birth control were almost as vicious as they were on abortion.
Yeah. And that we're talking about legitimate rape in, you know, exactly. 2013, 2012.
So if you have a social movement that's saying, you know what, the birth control pill is in fact an abortion, it's very, very hard to get the kind of common ground that many of us wish for.
But it might be really worthwhile to start those conversations somewhere. I wish we had more time. We're going to have to close that for today. I want to remind everybody that this Saturday, Rose Aguilar will be moderating a Roe v. Wade celebration at 10 a.m. at Justin Herman Plaza in downtown San Francisco. You can go to yourcallradio.org for more information. Again, that's this Saturday at 10 a.m. I want to thank my guests for being with us. Carol Joffe is a professor at the Bixby Center for Global Reproductive Health at UCSF and a professor emerita at UC Davis. She's also the author of Dispatches from the Abortion Wars, The Costs of Fanaticism to Doctors, Patients, and the Rest of Us. Jasmine Burnett joined us by phone from New York. She's a founding member of Trust Black Women Partnership, and she's a leader of the New York Coalition for Reproductive Justice. Also, Darcy Baxter, who's a Unitarian Universalist minister and a regional organizer for the California Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. Thank you all. Thanks to everybody who called. I really apologize that we couldn't get to everybody. We'll have links at our website. It's yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. How does California get back on the right fiscal track? On the Next Your Call, we'll be responding to Jerry Brown's State of the State address. The deficit is gone, but many Californians are still reeling from the deep cuts of the last 2 years. Brown calls his new budget a breakthrough, but how will he restore funding to social services? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What do you hope the new state budget will prioritize? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.